You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks.
Bye.
Hey, you. Welcome to this week's episode of Sex Gets Real. If you are listening to this on Sunday, July 23rd, then today is the next Sex is a Social Skill group call. Every 2 weeks, I'm doing live calls where we're diving into all kinds of super rad stuff, practicing skills, creating community. This week's call is all about respect. We're going to kind of unpack what it means to have self-respect and also talk about what it looks like to have respect in relationships. So if you want to join in the call, head to sexgetsreal.com or check out the show notes for this episode because I've got a link so that you can get signed up. I would love to have you there. And of course, people who support the show at the $20 per month level on Patreon get free access to those group calls. So even if you can't join in the group calls, you want to throw a dollar or three or a couple more my way to help with the show, you can do that at patreon.com/sexgetsreal. So let's talk about this week and this very special episode. So you know that I just recently moved to Vancouver, Canada, and I am loving it here. It is The weather in the summer is a far cry from the Washington, D.C. area, and it is an improvement in my eyes. But Zena Sharman, who is the editor of a new book called The Remedy, Queer and Trans Voices on Health and Healthcare, she's actually local. And so we got together in person and recorded this chat. We were just sitting in a room geeking out. We had an amazing time. We talked for, 45 minutes before we even started recording the show. So this entire episode is all about health and healthcare, specifically accessing it when you are in some type of oppressed or marginalized identity or situation. So Zena is an expert in queer and trans health, and there are some amazing people out in the world making healthcare and access to health a lot easier for people who are queer and trans. But we also talk about how it can be really, really hard to have good healthcare and positive experiences with doctors if you're kinky or if you're poly, certainly if you're in a fat body or if you've had trauma of any kind, if you're a person of color or you're indigenous. So it's an amazing conversation where we talk about things like a trans buddy system. And we talk about what it really looks like to have trauma-informed care and to have doctors who actually treat us as equal partners, who understand that we live in our bodies and we are the experts in our bodies, and so actually respect that as a position of power. And we kind of break down all the different ways that marginalized communities, especially queer and trans communities and trauma communities, are coming together and offering each other care from a place of like interdependence, which kind of flies in the face of our very capitalist, self-sufficient, pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of narrative that we have of like, I'll figure it out and do it on my own. I don't need anybody. And kind of the power of receiving and giving care, which I think is something that's so needed in kinky communities and swinger communities and poly communities. And so I'm hoping that this conversation inspires lots of us to kind of think about community and care and health in a really, really different, radical way. And then another thing that's super awesome about Zena is she's so plugged in to so many different, really, really great communities and leaders. She has a whole bunch of great recommendations through our chat for other books. There's a book she recommends that's specifically on learning how to set better boundaries. So I already ordered the book because I'm really excited. But I think you're going to really enjoy this episode. It's something that's so important, especially when we talk about sexual health and STIs and being able to have really radically open conversations with our healthcare providers if we do sex work or if we're poly and we have multiple partners. So how do we get there? Zena has some ideas. So let me tell you a little bit about Zena and then we will jump in. Zena Sharman is a femme force of nature and a passionate advocate for queer and trans health. She has over a decade's experience in health research, including 7 years as the assistant director of Canada's National Gender and Health Research Funding Institute. Zena co-chairs the board of the Catherine White Holman Wellness Center, a holistic healthcare center for transgender and gender diverse communities. She served on the board of the Canadian Professional Association for Transgender Health from 2013 to 2015. So you can also already hear, like, Zena is super into trans and queer healthcare in a really amazing way. Zena is also the editor of the Lambda Literary Award-winning anthology, The Remedy. The Remedy brings together her love of writing and stories with her commitment to making the world a much healthier and more equitable place. She also co-edited the Lambda Literary Award-nominated anthology, Persistence, Always Butch and Femme. And she's presented on gender, sexuality, and health to audiences all around North America. She has a PhD in interdisciplinary studies from the University of British Columbia, and her resume also includes party thrower, cabaret host, go-go dancer for a queer punk band, campus radio DJ, and elementary school public speaking champion. There's a whole bunch of other rad information about Zena at sexgetsreal.com for this episode, and I hope you enjoy our very vivacious and fun in-person in Vancouver, Canada chat. So here we go. This is my first live interview since moving to Vancouver. So welcome to the show.
Thanks, and welcome to Canada.
Oh, thank you. Feels so good.
I feel like I should really play out my Canadian accent that I probably have for your American listeners. I'll just say a boot a lot. I would also like your listeners to know that you're wearing really nice glitter eyeshadow.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
So your efforts do not go unrecognized.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for bringing your glittery self to our country.
You're so welcome. Yeah, maybe like we should end every sentence with like, eh?
It does happen sometimes.
Yes, it does. I encountered that in Toronto when I was there.
There was once many years ago, I grew up in a border community, so my city was just very close to the Minnesota border, and I remember driving across, hanging out, meeting some Americans, and they said, oh, you're from Canada. Do you know so-and-so?
Of course.
And then I knew the person.
Oh, no!
And I was like, okay, you just need to know that this is a total coincidence. Okay, I don't know all of Canada.
Right.
There's tens of millions of us.
So how I found you was your incredible book that just recently came out called The Remedy, which is all about trans and queer health and stories, which one included Sinclair Sexsmith, who we've had on the show, talking all about kink and submission and all that good stuff. But the book is absolutely beautiful. I felt so moved, and I cried, and I felt angry, and I think one of the things that just struck me so much was this is one of the first times that I've had the opportunity to sit in these voices from people who have experienced these very often violent experiences within the medical community. And so I'm kind of wondering, like, for you, what was it like to decide you wanted to cultivate these stories and then to actually bring them together?
Well, thank you for your really amazing words about the book. First, I really appreciate that, and especially hearing how you engaged with the stories. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I love so much about anthology is that it's a form that allows the reader to experience so many different voices and perspectives. You know, when there are pieces you read that resonate deeply with you, there are pieces that are surprising or enraging, there are those ones that move you to tears. So with the project, I mean, really the idea grew out of I think, two strands. Mm-hmm. One was my love of anthologies, my love of writing, my passion for queer art and culture, and really seeing that as an important tool of social justice, and also the power of representing our stories in books and other media. And it also was born out of my background in health research and teaching, in this case, actually first-year med students. I was part of a group of folks guest lecturing in the very weirdly titled lecture called Sexual Medicine Day, which I'm saying in quotation marks, which somehow became the LGBTQ health lecture.
Interesting.
I know, it's weird.
Yeah.
I don't know how the name evolved, nor where the Sexual Medicine Day came from. Not to be confused with Sexual Healing Day, which is obviously different. Brought to you by Marvin Gaye. So teaching in Sexual Medicine Day, teaching on LGBTQ health, and not only getting to lecture, you know, it's like hundreds of students, they're really listening, they've got really good questions, but then afterwards getting to sit down in a tutorial in a much smaller group and talk with a group of students in a more kind of one-on-one way, where they were asking questions about who I was as a queer person and really wanting not only to get to know me, but really to understand like how, as a future doctor, they could do a really good job of taking care of me and people in my community. And so those things really knitted together in the genesis of this project, you know, and I realized that I wanted to do a book that put people's stories and put people's voices at the center of the conversation, because so often LGBT health, queer and trans health gets talked about or written about, again, in forms that are really useful, but maybe less accessible. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's an academic journal article, maybe it's a clinical practice guideline that tells doctors or nurses or other healthcare providers how to care for people.
Yeah.
But it's not that gateway to empathy, understanding, connection, and being able to viscerally feel the impact of your actions.
Yes.
Because the book is really, it's both for the queer and trans community, and it's also very much for healthcare providers, people training to be healthcare providers, you know, anybody else with a stake in queer and trans health.
Yeah. I had the opportunity this year to be part of a six-month program with the American Medical Student Association, and I had a group of about five second and third year medical students, and for 6 months all we talked about was aspects of sexuality and sexual health. And I think one of the things that struck me was, even though they were bringing their personal values to the table, so there was definitely strong feelings about like, well, I'd never want my parents to be kinky. But if someone shows up in my office who's kinky, of course I want them to feel safe and disclose. And finding them kind of trying to grapple with that, how can I be the best doctor possible? And also, like, this feels really foreign to me. And they were so eager to ask questions and to understand and to kind of go into these places that they had never even considered. And at the same time, having them come into our meetings and hear about the ways that kind of the larger medical program they were in was already starting to beat out of them that it's okay to spend time with people. It's okay to really ask personalized questions. It's more about how can I be as efficient as possible to get to the answer. And so it was just kind of fascinating to see them starting to try and find ways to, like, how can I be super accepting and ask open-ended questions without assuming anyone's gender and still kind of meet these kind of industry expectations around, like, efficiency and insurance. And it kind of made me hopeful that the medical students were so interested, but it also made me feel kind of sad that, like, the larger institutions in place weren't supporting the knowledge that they were getting. It's kind of like they're going to have this knowledge and then not really have a lot of control over how to use it.
I think that's such an important story, because I think it really centers that notion of doctor or future healthcare provider of any kind as being embedded in systems and institutions, right? Mm-hmm. And so just like systems and institutions have the potential to be anti-oppressive, we also know that they absolutely have the power to be oppressive, right? So that can happen at an individual level. You know, maybe it's a doctor being transphobic or homophobic toward a patient or racist or otherwise discriminatory, but that also gets built into an institution as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was one of the things that, like, really stood out to me as I was reading these stories is, you know, as someone who is, one, a survivor, and two, has lived in a fat body my whole life, I've had really terrible and sometimes dismissive and borderline abusive experiences with doctors. And to then read these stories of people who were, you know, Indigenous or First Nations or trans or intersex, and seeing a lot of those same stories being paralleled around institutions deciding that if you don't fit into a very normative kind of situation, then there's just something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. And we're just kind of push through all the things that you might need, and I'm just going to apply kind of the template that I use with everyone, and how that actually feels really harming for so many different people. And I was thinking, like, I know so many kinky people who would never disclose to a doctor that they're kinky, because then the conversations around, oh, well, that's abuse might come up. Or folks who are poly, and I had a situation where some friends who were poly were just really confronted with having multiple partners present in the hospital when they were ill, and how that presented a lot of issues. And it's kind of like anyone who's in a marginalized identity has the potential to bump up against so many of these like oppressive frameworks that happen inside of medicine. And it's hurting all of us. You know, we don't get to actually get the care that we need. And that came through so much in all these stories that you brought together of just, like, look at all the ways that we're failing our community.
And I think it's also an opportunity to think about where is the potential mm-hmm. for solidarity, right?
Yeah.
Because you are naming a reality, which is these kinds of things, you know, the kinds of discrimination maybe that a bisexual person might experience with a healthcare provider who is making assumptions about their identity, their desires, who they may or may not be partnering with, or what their risk factors may or may not be. You know, that person may have a set of experiences that somehow connect up with, even if they look kind of different from the experience of a fat person who is getting discriminated against by their healthcare provider.
Yeah.
So, like, where is the potential for folks that experience marginalization or oppression or discrimination in the health system to come together and
yeah.
say, hey, wait a minute, that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I think it's also such a huge call to action and an opportunity for healthcare providers.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I've always said when I've done this kind of education for trainees, for med students, let's say, is to say, look, learning how to not make assumptions about the person in the room with you benefits all of your patients.
Yeah.
This isn't just something that applies to the person who maybe is trans in front of you, or queer, you know, or kinky, or poly, or whatever.
Yeah.
It really is an invitation to a different kind of dialogue and exchange. And how do you actually get to learn about that person in the fullness of their life and their identity?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're not just these sacks of organs walking around, right?
Right.
We're human beings in relationship, like, with ourselves, with each other, with the world, you know, with our histories of trauma, however we carry those in our bodies, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in the context of, I think, even more and more literature talking about intergenerational trauma.
So, yes.
Like, what does it mean to be a queer person and a trans person? And we do have this lineage of trauma that may come up kind of through our identities, as well as potentially through our own family histories as well. How do we navigate that in a healthcare encounter? And how can we build a health system that's able to really meet and honor us where we're at?
You know, it's really interesting because so much of what is in these stories from The Remedy is people and communities coming together outside of the medical establishment to care for each other. Like the community acupuncture that gets featured. And that was actually, for me, one of the most healing stories that I read around, you know, people coming together on the backs of the Black Panthers and the Young Lords, who actually were creating community health care because of police violence and, like, institutional racism. And to have people who were like, I'm going to learn how to do acupuncture, and I'm going to charge you as little as I possibly can so that we can all heal. And I can so see certain elements of that within all of the various communities that we have within fat communities, you know, trying to validate for each other, like, you don't have to change in order to actually be seen as a human being, or kink communities helping give each other little tips around how to heal bruises or hide them. And, you know, we all kind of have these little hacks. And I'm wondering, like, for you, I know that there are people out there who are 3D printing speculums and trying to offer each other, like, gynecological care outside the system, and we've got community acupuncture, and kind of, what do you see as the role of community healthcare? Is there dangers in it, potential in it? I mean, how can we kind of support each other through these places that the medical establishment is really failing right now?
I really appreciate that you highlighted the piece about community acupuncture, because I think one of the real beauties of that piece, and it's written by Lisa Baird, and I was able to see her read it live at the launch of The Remedy in Toronto, and it was so powerful to hear Lisa read that piece live. And I remember feeling and looking around the room, I was not the only one that was crying while she read that piece, and the feeling that I had was she was giving us a possibility model. And it was that feeling like another world is possible. You know, we can create ways of caring for one another that really honor trauma, that honor the fact, in this case, you know, Lisa talks about being a healthcare practitioner and also a queer person and a survivor, and like, what does it mean to bring the fullness of her identities and really see those as gifts, and also being held in the way that she's able to practice in community acupuncture.
Yeah.
So I love the example of that piece as a way to kind of imagine, like, how do we extrapolate this?
Yeah.
You know, when I think about one of the other pieces you mentioned briefly, like Sinclair Sexsmith's piece, one of the things Sinclair talked about is basically crowdsourcing so much health information, because they were like, well, the medical system can't give me the information that I need, so I'm going to take matters into my own hands.
Yeah.
You know? And as much as, of course, there's complexity and maybe some kinds of risk, in having to fill in the gaps in information that maybe don't exist in maybe more formal settings or in the knowledge bases of our healthcare providers, it's also incredibly powerful and empowering to step back and say, okay, I'm the expert on my own body, and I am part of and held by a community, and we're going to figure this out together.
Yeah.
You know? And and there's another piece in the book, because I'll just talk about all of them. Okay. So Kelly Dunham has a really fantastic piece, and it's all about queer caregiving. And in this case, Kelly is talking about the experience of caring for a partner who's dying of cancer.
Oh, God, that story, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And I love how Kelly highlights the strengths of the queer community and basically is like, hey, everybody else, health system, you should really look at us and not try to make this a model where only one person or two people are allowed to be with, in this case, the dying person. How do we actually create a system that enables us to bring webs of people together to care for one another?
Yeah.
So again, I feel like there's an enormous amount of opportunity to look at the ways we as queer people have held and cared for each other and like figured stuff out in the absence of information or systems that are not able to care for us.
Oh my God. Okay. So I have like so many things I want to talk about.
Right.
Yeah. okay. So going back to the community acupuncture, and was it Lisa that wrote that? Yeah. So one of the things that like really struck me powerfully is, you know, I talk constantly on the show about consent culture and rape culture and the importance of just like respecting the sovereignty and autonomy of another human being and letting them choose what happens to their body. And yet, we in no way have a consent culture within our medical institutions. And, you know, I know there was a heartbreaking story where someone's getting, like, genital exams and no one's telling them why or what's happening to them. But in Lisa's story, she was talking about how, I'm assuming that Lisa uses female pronouns, but Lisa was talking about how at their center where they were doing community acupuncture, that people who came got to choose for themselves every single thing that happened to their body, how their body was positioned, where they sat, that they got to be fully in control of their experience. And that was like, one, it had never even occurred to me that I could receive care in that way, because I've never seen it done. I've never had someone ask me where I would prefer to sit in the room, you know, or when I'm ready to be touched. It's just, I'm just going to do the things and you have to tolerate it, which is the opposite of consent culture. But so I thought that was really beautiful. And it also felt really kind of scary, because for me, sometimes my body is not a safe place for me to be, and it can sometimes also be really foreign. And so this thought of like, I get to be fully in control of my body and the experience, and my body has all of this wisdom, it also kind of brings up this like, sometimes my body is in a safe space, so then how do I navigate that? And it brought up these like paradigm shifting questions and thoughts that it just never even occurred to me. Like, what if every time we saw somebody who was going to have anything to do with our body, they checked in with us and asked us, may I touch you in this way? Or what would make you more comfortable? Like, that's just so foreign to me, isn't it?
I mean, what your listeners can't see is me nodding emphatically at Dawn right now. Yes. I mean, yeah. it would be a radical culture shift.
Yeah.
And it would require massive changes to the way that we educate healthcare providers and structure the health system, which isn't to say that those models don't exist, right? Yeah. I mean, for example, we see them in community acupuncture. I think also they're more and more present in trauma-informed care. And yes. I think there are more and more healthcare providers that are really thinking about that, which is so important, right?
Yeah.
So how do we actually build consent culture into the health system? How do we let someone know what's happening and talk them through the process and really, again, meet the patient as an engaged partner in the process,
yeah.
right? And honor your bodily autonomy, your expertise, because you're the person that's living in that body 24/7, right?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's a humongous difference.
Yeah, and I even think just like this community and this trauma-informed approach, I think would leave so much more space to start deconstructing some of the ableism that's inherent in the medical community of like, of course you want to be fixed or different. Of course you want to be normal, and kind of forcing people into treatment regimens without really explaining to them what's going to be happening, or assuming that if you're fat, of course you want to lose weight. You know, there's like all of these ableist ideals baked into medicine because medicine at this point in time assumes that what's best for the patient is conformity with what they think is the one way to be healthy. And so I see so much more opportunity in these other approaches to wellness of like, maybe I don't want to get better. Maybe I just want to live the best that I can with what I have now. Or maybe I'm super happy the way that I am, even if that boggles your mind. So then how do we work with that? You know, and I think that takes a lot more resilience and flexibility in care providers, which I think is also really scary to the medical establishment.
Absolutely. And like, what would it mean to build disability justice
yeah.
into our health system?
Yeah.
There's a really amazing book, so shout out to so many other writers out there. Eli Clare has a new book called Brilliant Imperfection, and I think the subtitle is Troubling Cure. And so Eli is a trans person, a disabled person, a survivor, and just a really brilliant thinker and writer, and someone who writes in this really powerful way that engages, I think, in a really accessible but complex way, theory and lived experience and engagement with the natural world and a deeply politicized approach to thinking about disability justice. And so the reason that feels so relevant in this conversation is one of the strong themes in that book is really troubling the notion of cure.
Yeah.
So that for sure, in some cases, and Eli gives the example of maybe someone who's living with really intense chronic pain, maybe for them to be cured of that chronic pain would be a welcome, life-changing shift. And then for other folks, they're so happy in their lived bodies, their existing bodies as a disabled person. So how do you just, again, meet people where they're at? And I think also push away potentially from, say, a focus on cure to how do we actually, not just at the individual level, but at the societal level,
yes.
create ways of inviting in full participation, autonomy, supporting people to live in the fullness of their lives, whatever that looks like for them. And again, I mean, I think this is one of the places where we start to touch into, like, where does the medical system or the healthcare system end and, like, the entire everything else begin?
Yeah.
On the way over here, because I'm super nerdy, I was reading a book about, an article, I should say, about teaching the social determinants of health in medical education. And it was really interesting, like, very activist-oriented, critical perspective on it coming from a group of folks within medical education. And one of the things they were talking about is, like, how do we actually push away from a model that basically doesn't give, in this case, medical students the opportunity to not just look at a list of things that might influence health. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's your income, maybe it's your age, maybe it's your race or ethnicity, your gender, your sexual orientation. Like, yes, all of those things are real, but how do we actually have a model that positions those facets of identity in a power structure of intersecting oppressions and privileges?
Yeah.
How do you enable healthcare providers to actually reflect on their own privileges and power and how they might actually participate in oppression?
Yeah.
How do you, and they talk about this idea of doctor citizen, so how do you actually train healthcare providers to become these active citizens who want to participate in overturning disparities, mm-hmm. and not just doing that at the level of how do I help this individual patient.
Yeah.
It's like, how do I create access to safe and affordable housing? How do I support food justice so people can have access to food that is healthy and nourishing to them and their communities? How do I create disability justice so we have accessible communities where folks of all kinds of bodies can really thrive and participate?
Yeah.
What would that mean to transform healthcare like that?
Right.
I mean, that's the world I want to work toward. And, you know, I don't expect that that's going to happen in my lifetime. But the remedy is absolutely, you know, a drop in that magical bucket of social change.
Yeah. Well, it just makes me think, and this is one of the other things I really want to talk to you about, is kind of this model of interdependence, which I think is really clear in so many of the stories and just kind of thinking about like community activism for so many different things, you know, not just healthcare, but even just like sexual health and sexual exchange. And when we have a community where we're actually accountable to each other, but also available to receive support and actually not feel bad about receiving support and give support, I think if we were actually involved in community in that way, that would completely revolutionize the way that we offer care. You know, so even if our profession is to be a medical provider, if we are deeply entrenched in our community and we actually have an opportunity to have real conversations and see real impact, I think it changes the way we offer the care ultimately. And so you wrote this beautiful blog post on your blog, which I'll link to in this episode, called Queer Interdependence. And it moved me so much, but you were really touching on this. And I've mentioned this on the show a couple of times, where like we're kind of in a culture that highly prizes individualism, like to the extreme, where you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and like you make it work no matter what, and it's all about mindset, and if your mindset's not right, then everything else is your fault. And you know, and to receive help or to ask for help is really seen as weakness. Whereas within so many marginalized communities, interdependence and actually like offering support and care is a big reason that these communities have even survived. So I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit more, like your personal experience with it and maybe how we can build stronger interdependence in all the ways we have community.
Well, thank you for reading that blog post. And yeah, it was the piece I wrote on queer interdependence was partly inspired by my own personal experience of a period in my life where basically I would say it kind of was like a forest fire. Like everything that was kind of foundational in my life changed radically in a pretty short period of time. So this was in 2014. My mom died in 2014, and I'm an only child raised by a single mom. You know, that was really, she was sick for 6 years, lots of layers of complexity there. So she died in March 2014. And then my partner at the time, we split up in October of that year. And I moved out of the home that we shared together. And it was just like all the things that I thought, okay, these are the foundations. You know, it was just like, you know, everything went up in flames.
Right.
And it was incredibly difficult. I mean, there is no doubt that it was, I mean, to this point, who knows what the future holds, but it was absolutely the hardest experience I've had in my adult life, like bar none. And also it was profound how held I was through that process by my community. And you know, I'm someone who my own family history is definitely one that's really colored by really complicated experiences of abandonment. And like, I mean, I know you're a sex and relationship coach, so I know you can get down with some attachment theory.
Yeah.
I love me some attachment theory, like really. So, you know, how do I think about in my own lived experience what it means to like have complicated feelings around like trusting in the relationships that are core to my life. Like I bring that in, and that came with me through that whole process. Plus, of course, all of the kind of complex like capitalist narratives of self-sufficiency and independence.
Right.
So to be in a process where I was kind of just like so decimated by the experience that I couldn't not ask for and receive help, and receive so much more help than I was even asking for.
Yeah.
It was really profound. And so that was my entry point into writing that piece. But also really wanting to think about that again in a larger way, because I think there is an opportunity for us to really honor and lift up that interdependence much more than we're able to. And I think much more than, for sure, as you already touched on, those kinds of capitalist narratives of of, you know, you must be self-sufficient, asking for help is weakness. I think, you know, I'm so glad that Brené Brown had that super popular talk on vulnerability. Like, that was a game changer for me when I watched it years ago, because I think it actually was, again, one of those entry points for me in actually being able to invite in more interdependence and, like, welcome my own vulnerability, be able to ask for help, be able to say, hey, I can't hold all of this. Like, I'm not a superhero. Like, please, someone help me, you know? I think, how do we invite in more vulnerability? How do we honor that? How do we hold out more interdependence? How do we actually put that into action, not just in terms of receiving care, but also giving care?
Yeah.
There's disabled folks I know, and some of them are doing this really incredible work around forming care collectives, where they're basically self-organizing their own care. And again, that to me is such a powerful model, where there is a person at the center who is in charge, in the sense of saying, look, I'm the person at the core of this. These are the needs I have. Community, I need you to step up for me and do this kind of care, whether it's coming in and doing meal preparation, bodily care, whether it's going out and running errands, that kind of thing. And again, that to me is a very specific model. And again, I'll give shout outs to the disability justice community, because that's where this work and wisdom comes from. But I feel like that's such a powerful model for thinking about what interdependence could look like.
Yeah.
And I feel like we can all invite more interdependence into our lives.
Yeah. It's been a really interesting experience leaving DC, where, you know, in my years there, I had a really serious bout with depression for a number of years, and then I really came out of that because I was so held, and I had so many beautiful friends that were really able to just allow me to be where I was, and that was super healing. And at the time, I was also moving in witchy circles and doing a lot of healing, just kind of like spiritually. And now, in my experience of like living every day with anxiety, you know, I left a tribe behind of people who I felt comfortable asking for help. And that's a really hard thing to do, I've noticed, especially depending on kind of your identity and how you move through the world and kind of how you grew up. But, you know, for me, asking for help is a really hard thing. It feels like a burden that I'm placing on someone else. And so to have friends where I could actually ask for that help and have it received and trust that when they gave it to me, it was because they really wanted to, but they could care themselves through yes or no's. And also being able to support them in that way, and to move away from that, and to kind of feel what it's like to not have that right now, and trusting that it will come again. But it's a very interesting experience to like know you have community and care, and that when you need to, you can ask for help, and then to actually see yourself removed from that. It's a really interesting experience, and it also makes me feel heartbroken for people who don't have access to that kind of thing. And I think oftentimes folks who are, you know, heterosexual and cis and kind of following all of the social cues, I think often are super lonely because there isn't kind of that baked-in community of we have to be together because the world's not safe for us. And just kind of encountering this loneliness for lots of different reasons, or even folks with disabilities who are just in rural areas and don't have access to friends and community, you know, just kind of like thinking through what does it mean to have interdependence and community, and what does it also mean when you don't have that and you miss it or you need it, you know, and then like how do we care for ourselves through that?
Absolutely. Well, and I think to acknowledge, as you pointed to in the examples you're giving, interdependence is a privilege, or it can be a privilege, right? Like that kind of access to community is not something that everybody has. And it's not something that everybody in the queer and trans community has, you know, let alone society at large. Because I agree with you, I think kind of other sort of more normative family structures can be really isolating potentially. You know, if you look at maybe a more sort of quote unquote nuclear family model where, you know, it's a husband and a wife raising kids together, and it's the two of them and those kids, like, that would feel incredibly isolating. It's hard to raise children. You need people around you. And I also, again, want to name that in the context of the queer and trans community. Yeah. Like, even in my own experience, and I appreciate receiving even just some feedback on the piece that I wrote about this in a way that was gentle, but also a really important reminder for me that I am a person that is privileged to be tapped into a lot of community. You know, I've been where I am for 16 years now. I know a lot of people, and that has made a huge difference for me in terms of my access to support, and also that my need for access to support was within a relatively time-bound period, right? Yeah. I mean, it was a year, but it wasn't, hey, I'm interdependent and I will be this type of interdependent for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, I think how do we think about that?
Yeah.
And how do we cultivate interdependence in our own lives in ways that feel really healthy and nourishing for us?
You know?
I always say it's like, I don't want queer codependence.
Right.
You know, I've done enough work to be less codependent. That's real. How do we have healthy boundaries?
Yeah.
And how do we also move away from this notion that it's not okay to ask for help and that it's not okay to offer help? Again, yeah. I think that's that sort of dance of codependence and boundaries and interdependence. Like, there's lots kind of wrapped up in there.
Yeah, because I think, you know, one of the things that just, like, comes up over and over and over again anytime I'm talking about sex is I still get lots of pushback from people around the very basics of consent. You know, that in itself can feel super threatening, especially to folks who have been assigned male at birth and socialized within a toxic masculinity model. But to even be able to have these conversations where we're talking about it's okay to ask for help, and beyond that, to know what it means to have healthy boundaries requires some communication skills of, I have to have resilience around receiving someone's no, even if I really want their yes, and trust that they're taking care of themselves. And I think for so many people who are listening, you know, to have a tough conversation where someone might reject your question is catastrophic, you know, and like just culturally we don't have the tools or the skills to be able to set even the most basic of boundaries, and we certainly don't trust people with their yeses or their nos. You know, culturally we're expected to pressure our friends into joining us into things. We can't respect the no or to judge people for their yes. And so we would have to, as just kind of a collective culture, find skills that allow us to have these conversations so that we could even trust people when they said, I really want to care for you, or I can't offer that kind of care for you, and to know, like, it's not them saying, ew, no to you, but this is me caring for myself, and I still love you, that's why I'm saying no. You know, that's like next level relationship and communication skills, and like sometimes I'm like, we've got a ways to go, because we're still kind of at the place where like pressuring people into sex is okay for a lot of people.
Yeah. There's a really great book. So, I mean, again, I will just keep talking about books because I'm that person that's, like, always reading all the time. There's a great book called Living in Liberation by Kristen Storm, I think is the author's name, and it's all about boundaries.
Oh, okay. I want to read this book.
I feel like it might be your jam.
Yeah.
And so what I love about it is that, again, it's a really thoughtful exploration of boundaries, like definitely in a very social justice informed kind of way. But one of the things I found that was a helpful takeaway for me after reading it was remembering that a boundary can be a no, and a boundary can also be an enthusiastic invitation in.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is something that I think sometimes gets lost in the conversation around boundaries. And so that is something that could be applied in a day-to-day context around giving or receiving care. It absolutely could be applied in a sexual context. And, you know, that doesn't mean that if you're getting a no to say, you know, can we have sex? If the answer is no, that doesn't mean that, you know, you talk your way around
right.
until you find an enthusiastic yes, right?
Right.
You need to know when to respect the no.
Yeah.
However, I think it is a really great way to kind of step back and think about that. Like, how can I change a medical encounter?
Yeah.
If we had a consent culture where, you know, you were having a negotiation, right? Like,
yes.
maybe you're going in for a pelvic exam. And it's like, okay, can I put the speculum in you? No.
Yeah.
How would you feel about putting the speculum in yourself? Okay, it might not be an enthusiastic invitation.
Right. But you're like, well, that feels a little bit better.
Right?
Right.
So maybe there can be at least that kind of exchange. Maybe a speculum is a bad example. I don't know. I mean,
no, I think it's a great one.
Some people love a speculum. That's real.
Totes.
It's a whole other conversation. However, I think, again, the place where there is, you know, the hard no, the not right now, the not with you, but also the getting to a maybe, but maybe not today, or again, maybe not with you, and then moving into that territory of the enthusiastic yes. And I think absolutely that can can apply to experiences, but I think it also can apply to processes mm-hmm. of giving and receiving help.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's so important to just like think about of there's so many situations in our lives where I think until someone actually tells us it's okay to say this thing, you don't know you're allowed to say the thing, right? Like, I didn't even know about the word consent until I was in my mid early 20s. Like, I understood the, you know, no touching people when they don't want it kind of thing, but I didn't have the language for that. There's still so many people who don't. But it never would have occurred to me, and I think even now it would be really hard for me to tell a doctor no. You know, like, okay, we're going to do this. Actually, I need a minute. Like, that would be so hard. And I think a lot of people don't even know that they have that option because it feels like a powerless situation where things are just being done to you. And I think often people in various types of genders and bodies feel like sex and relationships kind of experience the same way. Or like, these are just things that are done to me. And as long as it's not really painful or like grossly abusive, then my job is to just take it or to tolerate it. Or it's not so bad that I should leave. I can tolerate this kind of like, meh, I guess it's okay place. And I think it's so often because people haven't been told, like, here's all the ways that you can actually negotiate, advocate for yourself, say, this doesn't feel very good for me. But I'm not saying I don't want it to happen. I'm just saying maybe we need to change the circumstances. I mean, that's just a big, huge permission slip that I think so many of us don't have just in the most basic places in our lives. You know, and then to step into a place where like a doctor or a hospital where it feels like all of these people know so much more than you, it becomes infinitely harder, I think, to start advocating for yourself. Especially when you're talking about things like genitals or sex or STIs, you know, I mean, that just kind of ups the shame factor for so many of us.
Absolutely. The phrase that came to mind when you were talking was, trauma is an endurance sport.
You know? Yes.
And that's real and complicated. Like, when we've experienced trauma, whether it's in the context of a medical encounter, whether it's at various points in our lives, I mean, we are both enduring that trauma, but it is also, as we move through life, carrying that trauma with us in whatever way that we do, right? Whatever our own journey of healing is, there is, I think, something, and I say this from my own experience of trauma, and especially in terms of kind of some of the things about my upbringing that I think really gave me a very strong capacity that I'm continuing to try and unlearn to just endure
yes.
through things, right? And so that's where I come back to that piece about how do I set boundaries? You know, yeah. how do I feel empowered to be able to ask for help? How do I feel able to say, yes, I will offer this, no, I can't offer that? Mm-hmm. And I think in the context of the health system, that is often not only a site of trauma for so many people in yeah. general, and certainly for so many queer and trans people, it also is a site that triggers so many traumas for people. Mm-hmm. So there is no doubt to me that there are lots of people just dissociating their way through
yeah.
healthcare experiences or just white knuckling it through, you know, even if it's awful, they have made the Herculean effort to get into that clinic to
yeah.
do that thing or to go see that therapist or whatever it is. And I think it can be just hard enough to get through the door sometimes,
yeah.
let alone, as you pointed to, challenge the medical hierarchy. Mm-hmm. I know that I have a big advantage in a lot of my medical encounters because I have a PhD and I've worked in health research for many, many years. I am one of those patients, and I have white privilege, I have gender privilege, you know, I have thin privilege. Like, there's all these ways that a healthcare provider will look at me and say, okay, this is probably a patient who I will need to interact with differently than I might. For example, if I was dealing with somebody who was a patient who happened to be maybe a trans person who was street involved and also a person of color,
yeah.
that person should not get different care
yeah.
than I do, and they do.
Yes.
You know, my body is not a body that bears the brunt of the kind of discrimination and disparities that many queer trans people face today. And I know that because it absolutely affects the texture of the kinds of encounters I have with my healthcare providers.
Yeah.
And I also know because so many people in my community, so many people that I love, have painful and frustrating and invisibilizing and absolutely sometimes downright violent encounters.
Mm-hmm.
And we absolutely need to change that. And I think part of it is actually about shifting the hierarchy.
Yeah.
You know, and I know one of the things we were talking about earlier, so tell me if I'm getting ahead of ourselves, there's a really amazing program that's profiled in The Remedy that's called the Trans Buddy Program.
Oh my God, I love this so much. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it's so brilliant. Mm-hmm. You know, they did this in Nashville, and basically they trained advocates to go and, of course, you know, with the enthusiastic invitation of a trans patient, they could have a trained health advocate accompany them to an appointment. Mm-hmm. What a game changer.
Yes.
Right? Like, it can be triggering enough to just be in the room. And of course, if we're feeling triggered, how the heck are we going to be able to take in and process information? Will right. we feel able to advocate for ourselves? Will we actually even be in our bodies?
Yes.
So if you could be in a situation where maybe you actually don't feel like you can bring your whole self to bear in the same way that you might want to be fully present in that encounter, because maybe actually dissociating is like the way to get through your pelvic.
Right.
Like maybe that's your strategy.
Right.
But if there could be someone in the room with you who's like, I got you,
yeah.
you know, and I am the person who will advocate for you. I will make notes. I will ask questions. Like, I will help to disrupt the hierarchy. And it also, again, demands shifts in how healthcare providers interact with patients, because that comes back to how we design the system.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot more talk of patient and family-centered care. You know, that's a very big focus, even in the province that you and I are living in now. But it actually also demands a really big transformation of the health system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As soon as I read about the Trans Buddy program, I was like, oh my God, I need this. Not only for folks who are in fat bodies, because I think that's a really important place where so many people who are in fat bodies refuse to go to the doctor, because whenever they go, it's all about, well, you have to lose weight. Like, I actually had a situation last summer where I fell and actually injured my knee, and the doctor just wanted to talk to me about, well, your knees hurt because you're fat. And I was like, no, I actually acquired an injury, but they weren't interested whatsoever in that. And so I actually took care of my own knee and was doing like remedies at home to help myself care through that, because I was like, I don't need to deal with this crap. And also, just like for me, I tend to dissociate very much at doctor's offices unless I've established a very long relationship with a doctor over a long period of time, which I've been fortunate enough to do a few times. But as soon as I heard about that, I thought, one, I would love to be able to do that for others. Like, I would love to be able to go into a room, like, as a sex educator, I would love to be able to go into a room with someone and say, like, I will be there on your behalf to talk about your STI status, to ask questions about the types of sex that you want to have. If you can't bring yourself to say the words fisting or whatever it is, like, let me ask those questions for you and get that information, and then we can do this together. Or let me be there to hold the doctor accountable to not be focused on the size of your body and instead to be focused on your health. I mean, I just think there's so many beautiful applications of holding medical professionals accountable for the kind of care they're giving when you bring that third person into the room, you know, that can really be the voice and the eyes and the ears and say, like, this is what we need to be doing and these are the questions that we have. I mean, that, I love that program exists, and I wish it existed everywhere for so many different types of identities and experiences and bodies. You know, I mean, I was just like, this is brilliant. Like, until the medical industry and until just kind of these like systemic oppressions start shifting, to just know like someone can be there with me, it kind of comes back to that interdependence, right? Of like, I don't have to go through this alone. And I think that's like, that to me is exciting. It would make me be like, oh, well, I should go get that checked out. I'll just like, you know, hook up with my community buddy or whatever. And instead of like, well, 6 months later, I should have gotten that looked at, you know, which I think a lot of people do.
Absolutely. And I think that there is so much avoidance of healthcare because of the kind of fat-phobic discrimination you experienced, mm-hmm. which is, can I swear on your podcast?
Oh, yeah.
Bullshit.
Bullshit!
Total bullshit. Seriously. Just checking.
Yeah.
I realize it's not entirely a family-friendly podcast, but it's good to know.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, just like the fat-phobic discrimination you experienced, I mean, there obviously is a huge amount of discrimination, especially transgender non-conforming people.
Yeah.
Bisexual people experience a lot of health disparities. Mm-hmm. Of course, people who are racialized, people who are indigenous, people who are living in poverty, sex workers. I mean, again, folks who experience stigma and discrimination as a result of their identities, which is about oppression. It's not about who they are as individuals.
Yep.
It's not that they are more risky somehow. It's that they are living in structures that are creating more oppression and risk for them.
Yeah.
I mean, again, we absolutely should be able to have a system that meets them and honors them, and that doesn't discriminate and further traumatize.
Yeah.
So I would love to see a trained health advocate model, mm-hmm. you know, that's accessible to more people. And yes, as you know, like that is hopefully the bridge, you know, to the future transformation.
Right.
Like I would love for us to get to a place where you don't actually need to have a trained advocate with you in the room.
Yeah.
And we know that's not a short-term strategy, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, maybe it's an invitation to your listeners. Like, mm-hmm. maybe there are people out there that are listening right now and thinking, wow, it is really hard for me to go to the doctor. Like,
yeah.
What would it be like if I talk to that friend who I really trust?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they could come with me. Maybe we could tag off and be each other's buddy.
Yeah, I was even thinking, like, as we're talking, it doesn't even have to be like a formal program, right? I mean, like even within a kinky community, let's say there's a handful of you that all have been avoiding going to the doctor because you didn't want questions about your bruises or whatever it is that you've got going on in your life, and to actually like band together and say, let's go with each other to each other's appointments and just like be there to help take up that space and ask those questions. I mean, like that could be a radical experience for people. Or I mean, there's so many people that avoid getting STI testing because of the stigma associated with STIs. So to have a friend who's not going to shame you based on whatever your results are, actually be there with you and go through that. You know, I mean, like, it doesn't have to be these nonprofits that are huge and integrated with the medical system. I mean, that would be great. But I think you're so right. Like, even if we could just say, like, hey, trans buddy, like, let's the two of us go and call out this doctor and this nurse who constantly misgender you, you know, and like, I will be there for you to say like, nope, wrong pronoun. And you can just do whatever you need to care for yourself through that. I mean, we can totally advocate for each other that way. It would be amazing.
Absolutely. There's a really, there's a great scene. So Kelly Dunham, who I talked about earlier, who wrote the amazing piece in The Remedy about queer caregiving,
mm-hmm.
is also a nurse by training. And does a lot of health advocacy. And so Kelly has a zine that you can find online. It's called You Don't Have to Love Your Body to Take Care of It.
Oh, yes. I love that.
And it's basically, you know, Kelly's and I think kind of crowdsourced, really thoughtful, practical, funny, deeply trauma-informed advice for queer and trans folks accessing healthcare. And also, I would say so much of the advice is applicable to really anybody that feels barriers to accessing healthcare.
Yeah.
And part of it is definitely about kind of, I mean, I'll paraphrase, but it's really about understanding, like, what are the things you need to be able to get yourself through the appointment?
Mm-hmm.
And for some folks, it absolutely is to find a friend.
Yeah.
So, yes, if you can find that person, absolutely. Or, you know, if you have a relationship with someone in your community who maybe you have more privilege than in some regards,
mm-hmm.
and they enthusiastically consent, maybe there's an opportunity for you to lend some of that privilege. So let's say, for example, it's with a trans person that's experiencing a lot of discrimination in the health system with their enthusiastic consent, of course, because, you know, I'm always mindful of these complex power differentials and, like, not kind of trotting in as the savior.
Right.
But if this trans friend is like, hey, cis person, amazing. I would love for you to come to this appointment with me. Great.
Yeah.
You can drive me there.
Mm-hmm.
You can take notes. You can take me out for dinner afterwards, because it really feels great for me to, like, have a nourishing, delicious meal, like, after this stressful thing that I just did.
Yeah.
Also, I would like you to give me a sticker as a reward, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's available to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you don't need to go through creating a nonprofit, for example. Although if somebody wants to, I support
all
you.
For that.
Please.
Yes.
If there's a wealthy listener with a large endowment, a well-endowed listener, shall we say?
Yes.
Then
that's feeling generous.
Create that nonprofit. I'm excited about it.
God, that would be such a different way for so many different types of people to actually experience care. You know, I mean, like, I'm even thinking about sex workers, and, like, there's a story in The Remedy by a sex worker around, like, stigma within the medical community. And, you know, I think one of the things that's just, like, that just drives home over and over again the importance for all of us to be having these conversations is when our STI status is stigmatized, or our history as a sex worker is so stigmatized, or the fact that trans bodies are so stigmatized, we start hiding and lying the truth from others. And that can be harmful to others. It can be harmful to ourselves, certainly when we're not telling our medical professionals the full scope of what's going on with ourselves, because then we're only getting bits and pieces of care when we need something much more holistic. And it's like, I think that's the thing that people forget, is when we're shaming people for what's going on with their body or with how they're experiencing their lives, all we're doing is making health and wellness and connection impossible, because none of us actually get to say, like, here's what's going on for me, and now all of us get to have these open conversations and make good decisions for ourselves from this place of information. I'm giving you half truths to just kind of test if this is safe or not, and the second I feel like it's not, I'm just going to basically say what I need to get through this interaction. And, like, that doesn't serve any of us in our personal relationships or in our relationships where we're actually, like, trying to take care of our bodies and whatever that looks like. It's just, like, that was reinforced over and over and over again for me in all of the stories that were in your book.
Ugh. Well, and I think, again, that holding back and the place where our own internalized shame and our own internalized stigma bumps up against the kind of very real shaming and stigma that we can encounter. I mean, certainly in the world in general, but absolutely in healthcare encounters, you know, that can create so many barriers. And as you say, that kind of selective sharing of information. You know, I even think about recently, I went to the STI clinic to get routine STI testing, which is something I do because that's a sexually healthy thing to do. And, you know, I am this, like, out queer person, queer and trans health advocate. I gave a talk at the Continuing Professional Development Conference for all the sexual health care providers earlier this year, you know, in front of all these doctors and nurses, and talked about queer and trans health. And so with all of that context, plus all the privilege that I acknowledged earlier, I happened to be in a situation where they were going to pair me up with a male clinician. And I said, you know, I don't feel comfortable getting a pelvic with a male clinician. I prefer to see a woman. You know, that was an embodied consenting choice that I needed. They were definitely supportive of that. But the thing that became so interesting to me in terms of noticing my own internalized stigma is, instead of sending me back to the waiting room, they had me just sort of waiting at this weird junction in the hallway. And I happen to work in the health research field, and there are folks that I know absolutely that I've connected with when I've been up there on the podium as, like, out proud, you know, queer and trans health advocate, you know, talking about health, but also saying, like, I love queer sex, being queer is great. And there are also people that I know in my work life.
Yeah.
And of course I'm out as queer in my work life, but I'm not necessarily, you know, talking about all the sexy things at the boardroom table kind of thing. And so I was standing there in the hallway waiting for them to find me a clinician, feeling increasingly sort of weird and uncomfortable, and very aware that somebody I knew from my work life might walk by, because I knew one of them had an office down the hall. Mm-hmm. And I was standing there thinking, if I see this person, how am I going to explain my presence in the hallway?
Yeah.
And this is someone who is a sexual health clinician. This is someone who's a leading researcher in the area. And I still felt fear, despite all of my own kind of woke politics around this kind of stuff. I still felt fear and internalized stigma around how I could possibly talk about why I happened to be at the STI clinic getting routine STI testing. Oh, my God.
Right.
And noticing that I'm even saying routine STI testing, and that there's that part of me that feels like I need to say, oh, and it's just routine.
Right.
You know, just regularly scheduled maintenance.
Right.
That's my own internalized shame and stigma coming up. Right. So. Yeah. Just to name that and to say, look, like, this is a thing we are all carrying in different ways.
Yeah.
And that we live in a culture that is deeply repressive of all kinds of stuff about our sexualities, our genders, never mind everything else.
Right.
You know, I mean, I spent many, many years working in a gender and health focused research organization, and one of the areas that we funded and that I learned about some of the research on was around men's health specifically. And again, I feel like I have so much empathy for, like, cisgender straight men. I mean, Lord knows they piss me off sometimes when I want to rant about, like, the patriarchy and misogyny.
Yes.
Like, that's real. And also, I have real deep empathy for cis straight men. Because if you look at the statistics in terms of their health issues, you know, suicide rates. Like, there are so many ways in which their bodies are also bearing the brunt of incredibly restrictive norms around gender and sexuality. Like, so boxed in by, this is the only way to be a man.
Yep.
You know, whether that's, this is the only way to express your gender as a man, this is the only way to express your sexuality as a man, boys don't cry, like, yeah, whatever. You know, think of all the things that those folks need to unravel to be able to, again, slowly but surely, and hopefully with some luck along the way and meeting the right people, again, like, come into the fullness of their identities. Like,
yeah,
that's incredibly complicated. You know, just like I have my own complicated stuff around what it is to have been assigned female and, like, identify as female and socialize as a girl and as a woman. Like,
yeah,
that's its own complicated kettle of fish. But at least with the norms of feminine gender socialization, we apparently go to the doctor more often.
Right.
And we also take care of our partner's health.
Yes.
So that's a whole other conversation.
Well, and I think what's interesting, right, is, like, exactly what you said. I get so many questions from cisgendered men who are terrified of the way that their genitals are or not performing or look. The things that doctors say to them about sexual health, this kind of, like, you know, this cultural soup that we're swimming in, of course, carries over to people who are in the medical profession. It's like, it's not like they're completely isolated from all of the myths that exist around gender and bodies and norms. So, of course, doctors are constantly trying to push hard penises and, you know, intercourse is the only way that you're experiencing sex. And to have a doctor who you feel like has all the answers about your body tell you something is broken or not working or you need a pill, you know, that's incredibly harmful to just the way that you experience yourself. And so I think that's just, like, another layer of it all, right? Around, like, oh, you've got a vulva and you're not getting wet enough, in quotes, and then treating you like there's something wrong. And instead, you know, what if we were actually talking about, like, how are you experiencing your body? And what are all the different ways that you experience pleasure? I mean, pleasure is completely absent from any of the conversations that we're having right now in medical communities, for the most part. You know, small community and activist-y clinics, I think, do that. But I think you're so right. Like, there is no type of identity that's immune from the myths, the harms, the oppression that's existing. And, like, all of us are suffering from it, even if we don't think we are. You know, I think that's also one of the things that when you're a little bit more normative, you don't think that you're suffering in a lot of the ways that, of course, queer and trans folks are, and intersex folks are having a very unique, violent experience within our oppressive systems. But, like, all of us are being impacted by these very, like, short-sighted conversations that aren't centering the wisdom of our lives and our experiences, and instead just trying to say, like, here's what's normal, and now I have to try and fit every person that comes into my practice into this. And, like, everything I talk about on this show around, like, love and sex is to try and undo that, just constantly, like, let's pull us back out of that box over and over and over again, because all it's doing is just making everyone feel broken and or, like, they can't ask for help.
I'm not laughing at what you just said.
No, it's just like,
I'm responding to the and like empathizing with the depth of the sigh that just came after what you said.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be incredible to be able to have a health system and a society that honored us in the fullness of our identities,
yeah,
and met us where we were at?
Yeah.
You know, and that it wasn't about, here's all the ways you're weird, here's all the ways you're broken, here's all the ways I don't understand you.
Mm-hmm.
That was really about, hey, I would love to know more about who you are and what matters to you.
Yes.
And again, that isn't to say that there aren't incredible healthcare providers out there doing really amazing work, because I always really want to honor that.
Yeah.
I know there's also a lot of queer and trans folks working in the health system, you know, straddling both of those worlds and identities. Like,
yeah,
I think absolutely things are getting better, things are changing. There has been and continues to be a lot of activism,
mm-hmm,
from within the health system, the medical system, nursing care. I read a great article yesterday about some really amazing work actually being driven by midwives here in Vancouver that are really trying to have more trans-competent midwifery care. So really thinking about, again, like how do we provide pregnancy care for people who have bodies that, you know, can grow and bear babies, mm-hmm. and also that don't happen to be bodies that are identified as female. Like yeah. those are all really amazing shifts. And so again, I think they start to create possibility models. Just like when I look around my circles and think, okay, wow, my amazing queer femme friend, like, just graduated from nursing school. I'm so excited that she's out there as a registered nurse. Like, another amazing friend of mine is training to be a doctor. I cannot wait until that person is out there as a physician. Like, yeah. the change is happening, and of course, it's never fast enough for my liking.
Right, exactly. And I just, like, want to stress to everyone who's listening and feeling like, this doesn't really apply to me. You know, I think there's this fear that if we become too inclusive that we make things just so difficult to move through, when in fact it's the opposite, right? Like if we were able to walk into a doctor's office and have someone just have open-ended questions on a form where we got to just name all the things that were true about ourselves, that doesn't slow us down. That doesn't make it more difficult for people who do just check all the normal boxes, you know, in quotes, normal. But it gives us an opportunity to actually like use our own language about ourselves, even if our language is, I'm heterosexual, and I was born a male, and I identify as a man, and my name is David. You know, like, there's freedom in getting to actually use those words, because maybe I like to say male, and you like to say man. And now, as a healthcare provider, I get to say man, because that's what you like to do. And so I think it's just so important to kind of stress, like, when we have trans-informed and queer-informed and trauma-informed healthcare happening, every single one of us gets seen, whereas in the system that we've got now, only certain of us get seen, and the rest are just neglected or worse, right? And so it just, like, even though it can be hard to ask the new questions when we start arriving in that place, it actually becomes very easy to live in that space because it's just like, tell me about yourself, and now let's work from there. And I think that's just, I'm ready.
Yeah, well, and what would it be like if the conversation started from a place of, who are you and what matters the most to you?
Yeah.
So for example, you know, what if it was going in and having a conversation about the possibility of getting a surgery or not? You know, and it wasn't just about, well, you know, your knee looks like this, and therefore your surgical options are A or B. Mm-hmm. It's really about saying, hey, what brings you joy? Like, yeah. what kind of experience do you want to have? How could that inform our treatment? Is surgery going to be really painful and really disruptive in your life? Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe that's actually not the best option for you right now. You know, yeah. if you don't want to do that, what are the possibilities that are in front of us, right? So again, it becomes more of a dialogue. It's much more consent-oriented yeah. in the sense that the patient is able to really participate actively in the conversation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, as far as I'm concerned, would be revolutionary for all people. It's like, yes. are you listening to this podcast? Are you a human with a body?
Right.
Great.
Great.
If you're another kind of being with a body, it's potentially relevant to you if you're accessing healthcare.
Exactly.
You know? I don't know.
Oh my God. I feel like I could just like geek out with you forever, but we should probably wrap up because we are right at our hour. And so I would love it if you could share with people how they can find the book and how they can stay in touch with you online and just kind of see all those super rad stuff that you share.
Sure. Well, if you want to check out the website for the book, it's writetheremedy.com. So W-R-I-T-E, theremedy.com. And then I'm on Twitter at Zine Sharman, so people can find me on there. That's definitely a place I use to share, especially a lot of articles that I find, you know, things that are really interesting related to queer and trans healthcare. So it's a really good resource spot. And I will occasionally say interesting things, but definitely mostly use it to say, this thing is awesome, check it out. So those would be the two kind of best places to go.
Thank you so much for being here with me today.
You're so welcome, and thanks for the invitation. And it's exciting that it coincided with you moving to Canada.
I know, right? It was amazing.
I should have brought you some sort of maple-flavored candy or something. Next time.
Next time. Well, to everybody who joined us, thank you so much for listening. I hope that this was fun and validating and informative and makes lots of questions come into your head. And of course, I want to hear those questions. So if you go to sexgetsreal.com for this episode, you can find all of Zena's information and links to the book, The Remedy. And of course, you can let me know what you thought about this and maybe your ideas for how you can advocate for yourself and your friends better when it comes to your medical care and your sexual health. I would love to hear all the creative thoughts that all of you are having about this. So thank you so much, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.